Welcome to the More to the Story podcast. I'm so glad that you have come along. And many people have been wondering, now that we are in this phase where there's a breaking within the United Methodist Church to the Global Methodist Church and the dozens of other denominations and independent functions that churches have had, we've wondered, like, okay, well, what's going on now in United Methodist Church? And there's some very important things that we need to bring up that we hope will be of not just concern, but of interest to people for them to pray for this general conference as it's happening. So we're going to cover that on today's episode. But first, this podcast is brought to you by Wesley Biblical Seminary, where I serve as academic dean, and we are developing trusted leaders for faithful churches. And we have people across a host of Wesleyan denominations, the Global Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, and all sorts of others as well. And we would love for you to think about coming to our seminary. We have bachelor's, master's, doctoral programs, a course of study program for the Global Methodist Church, and a host of lay initiatives as well. So you can find out more about that at Wesley Biblical Seminary, I should say WBS.edu. Also, I'm thankful to my friends at WPO Development who helped make this podcast happen. They come alongside churches, schools, nonprofit organizations, and help them with capital campaigns, feasibility studies, mission planning studies. And they've done that successfully for more than 250 organizations. And I've used them on a number of occasions, and I highly recommend them to you. So you can find out more information about them in my show notes at wpodevelopment.com. Finally, I'd love for people to sign up for my email list. I send regular content out to people. It gets you aware of some of the things that are happening kind of in the pan-Wesleyan world. At the same time, if you sign up for that email list, I'll send you a free tool called 5 Steps to Deeper Teaching and Preaching. It's a 45-minute teaching and kind of like a guide, a 8-page PDF document that you can use to craft your own messages or Bible studies that go deeper into God's Word with the aim of coming up with a creative way to present that to people God's called you to serve. All right. I am so glad to welcome into the podcast somebody I've never had on before. I can't believe I never have. We've never met in person, but this is Reverend Tom Lambrick, who serves as the vice president for Good News for United Methodists, and he's an elder in the Wisconsin Conference of the United Methodist Church. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be with you, Andy. Thanks for the invitation.
You're welcome. Well, you're coming to us live from Charlotte, right? I believe you're there physically, right?
Yes, it's a beautiful city. We're enjoying being here.
Well, Tom, those people in my audience who are familiar with what's been happening in the United Methodist Church, and we've covered that on the More of the Story podcast for the last several years. We've talked to Rob Renfro, who serves with you at Good News. We've talked to various bishops in the GMC, people who've worked through the challenges in the UMC, some people who have stayed in. We've covered some of those stories as well. But many people, and I would say most of the people in my audience, probably are connected to churches that have disaffiliated, one of those 7,500 churches that have disaffiliated, or other denominations that are more evangelical, some might call more conservative. And in light of that, people might think, well, what do we need to think about the United Methodist Church now? We've left. There's nothing, you know, it's kind of in the past. Let's focus on the future. But I think there's some really key things happening. I'd love for you to help us know why you and Good News are present at the General Conference at this point.
Well, the reason we're here, Andy, is because of the African, particularly, delegates and the African part of the United Methodist Church. You may know that Africa makes up actually now more than half of the membership of the United Methodist denomination. They are underrepresented at General Conference. They only have about a third of the delegates here, but they are a very important and integral part of the United Methodist Church. And, you know, you have covered the fact that in the U.S., many churches have had the opportunity to discern their future, to determine whether the United Methodist Church is the appropriate denominational connection for them, especially in light of the changes that are going to be happening here at this general conference. And that same opportunity to discern their future has not been granted to churches outside the United States that are part of the United Methodist Church. And especially in Africa, where in many cases, the bishops have kept their churches in the dark, not shared information, have forbidden pastors from even talking about what's going on, prevented people from understanding the issues. And so we're here at General Conference to promote the idea that General Conference ought to give churches outside the U.S. the same opportunity, the same right to discern their future and disaffiliate if they choose, that was given to United Methodists in the U.S. We see it as a matter of simple fairness and justice, and that what we've been able to take advantage of ought to be made available to Africans as well.
So why is it legislatively that they were not able to get out? Is it just social in the sense that bishops are keeping information, as you indicated, or is there actually like a mechanism within the Book of Discipline that's keeping them from having that opportunity to disaffiliate?
Well, you may be aware that the process for disaffiliation in the U.S. was based on a particular paragraph in the discipline called paragraph 2553 that allowed local churches to vote by a two-thirds vote to disaffiliate if they chose to do that. And that paragraph was passed at the 2019 General Conference. At the same time, another provision that was passed at that conference said that legislation that was passed there would not take effect in the areas outside the U.S. until 1 year after the next General Conference, which was scheduled to be in 2020, a little over a year after St. Louis. Well, of course, you know that the pandemic disrupted that. And so the General Conference has not met until now. And so the provision for 2553 never took effect because it expired at the end of 2023.
Okay.
And General Conference hadn't met, and therefore it never went into effect. We think that the Council of Bishops could have asked the Judicial Council to allow for an exception to that policy because of the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic and the postponements. But they chose not to do that. And so that's why it never went into effect.
Gotcha. So now they're in place. So the actual legislation would just give that opportunity to any church to disaffiliate with two-thirds vote?
Well, there's actually two proposals that we're promoting here.
Okay.
That were both submitted by African delegates. One is to allow an annual conference to disaffiliate.
Okay.
An annual conference outside the United States. And this is because, especially in Africa, they tend to operate in unison on these kinds of issues, make decisions by consensus. And so it is far more likely that a whole annual conference would decide to disaffiliate than individual churches. And it would keep them together and help them to be a strong church moving forward. So That is one proposal, and it would give that opportunity to an annual conference. The other proposal is to extend the provisions of 2553 for another several years and make sure that it applies outside the United States as well as inside. And that way, churches, individual churches who are in an annual conference that decides not to disaffiliate, those individual churches could then disaffiliate if they wanted to.
So of those two options, are they both possible or do you prefer one or the other?
They're both possible. We're promoting both of them and we would like to see both of them pass.
Gotcha. Wow. That it'd be so interesting if that happened, particularly like on the first one that you mentioned at the annual conference is leaving. It seems like those who want to promote a progressive agenda would be glad for the African churches to leave, which would then increase their opportunities to then be able to, forgive me for just the easy word to say it, liberalize the Book of Discipline. I mean, wouldn't it be to their advantage for other churches, for conservative churches to leave?
You would think so, Andy. Unfortunately, they don't quite see it that way. I think that they think that that the African churches are being misused by conservatives in the U.S. to promote a U.S. problem, which is, you know, basically disagreement over the issues of homosexuality and sexual morality, and that they're being manipulated. And therefore, if they had their own ability to choose, they'd continue to choose wrongly because of the manipulation. So they believe that that it's not good for the churches in Africa to leave the United Methodist Church, and that therefore they don't want to promote that opportunity. What they're doing instead is promoting this idea called regionalization that would allow each part of the church to create its own reality. So you could have different standards for ministry, say in the U.S. versus Africa. You could have different standards for teachings on marriage, a different definition of marriage itself. Differences on all these things could be so that the U.S. can like run the church the way it wants to in the U.S.
Right.
Africa can run the church the way they want to in Africa. And therefore, they think that allows everybody to live together and not have to go through the disaffiliation.
It's been interesting to note that other denominations have tried to follow that same line. My former denomination, the Salvation Army, that's certainly one of the moves that's being made by those who want to see the Salvation Army adopt a liberalized sexual ethic, would be the same sort of thing. Well, let us just do this here. If it's fine for you to keep your truth over here, we'll have our truth on this side. I'm curious that as that's happening, like what is the best case in it? What's the best way they can position it? Like, so they're talking about region. Why would regionalization be good for those in the Central Conference and from their perspective? Like, like trying to play devil's advocate here. Like, let's give the best case scenario of what they're thinking.
Well, it would allow each region of the church to create church that is more compatible with their own culture and traditions and customs and things like that, in agreement with its country's laws and individualized so that it's not a one-size-fits-all denomination. And I also think that they're concerned about the issue of colonialism and how in the past, you know, the United Methodist Church has been mainly a U.S.-centered denomination with missionary outposts. Yes. And now that, you know, Africa has more members than the U.S. does, you know, the U.S. shouldn't be telling Africa how to run the church. So that's another strong argument that they make.
Well, it seems like then if that was really the case, they would listen to those on the other side. So what's the problem with that then? What's the problem with that line of argument?
So the problem with that line of argument is that it sets up the church to disintegrate, basically. What's unique about Methodism is our connectional nature, that we operate through connection with one another, and that that connection reinforces each other and allows ministry to be multiplied. If everybody has their own book of discipline, their own standards that are different from each other, it will create, we believe, a process of evolution where the church will evolve into these regional entities that are not as connected to each other as they are now. And so it's important to maintain some things that are in common amongst all the parts of the church. And, you know, we don't think that it's wrong for there to be different kinds of structures or different methods of worship or things like that in different countries. And obviously, one needs to be cognizant of a country's laws regarding how property is handled and things like that. There's no objection to that. But the kinds of things that they're wanting to make regional in nature are the foundational things, like what is the church's teaching on things like marriage and sexuality, and what are the standards for ministry, and what does that create? And so by making those regional, it really creates the kind of differences that lead to, I think, a disintegration of our connection.
I thought it was interesting a few minutes ago, you said that they could define their own reality. And that's like a real philosophical statement. And I think that's true. What happens in liberal theology in general, what happens in churches that affirm like that we can create our own truths and we can regionalize or localize, whatever it is, we then are altering truth. Like we think we're altering truth. And that's really problematic for us. Like, how can there be any foundation if everything is localized to the individual's subjective opinions?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The church is always a little slow. And the whole push philosophically has been in the past toward postmodernism, which is everybody has their own truth. And that's beginning to fade now. And philosophy is realizing, no, that you can't have that. It's every there is a common truth that people can point to. But now, just at that moment, that's when the church is starting to get on the postmodern bandwagon and adopt this idea of everyone having their own truth. So we're a little behind the times.
Right. Now, is there something else too connected to even some of the regions that have had, like, so I'm in Mississippi, and the church that I attend, disaffiliated, 90% joined the Global Methodist Church, is fairly seamless. And the bishop was, I wasn't a part of the conversations, but it was seemingly pretty an easy process for them to follow through on. They had to be careful with what they're doing, make sure they're doing everything right. But there's other conferences where it has not been as easy, and there's been more punitive measures put in place. Is that something that's being worked on as well at this general conference?
Absolutely. So the local church disaffiliation proposal is aimed at solving that problem. Of the 54 original annual conferences in the U.S., the vast majority, say 80% of them, handled the process in a straightforward way. It wasn't necessarily easy, but it was fair. And churches that needed and wanted to disaffiliate were able to do so. But there are about a dozen annual conferences that made it very difficult for churches to disaffiliate. They instituted complicated processes that hindered the process. They added costs and fees to the process that essentially priced churches out of the ability to disaffiliate, especially on the coasts. I mean, the East Coast and West Coast conferences, a number of them added the requirement that the church pay 50% of its property value. Wow. And, you know, property values in California and New York and New Jersey are sky high. And of course, small churches in particular could not afford to pay millions of dollars in order to disaffiliate. And so they were practically priced out of the market. And so we think that's unfair. It was a misuse of the process to prevent churches from disaffiliating rather than abiding by the intent of the process was to give churches a fair opportunity to disaffiliate. And there, in addition, there were some annual conferences where bishops and district superintendents and other leaders would say to the church, you know, the general conference hasn't met yet. We don't know what they're going to do. It's too early to disaffiliate. You can wait until after general conference and then you can disaffiliate. And so we feel like there needs to be an opportunity for those conferences that were promised that, the ability to disaffiliate. And right now, that's not in the Book of Discipline. And so we want to make sure that it is.
So churches that didn't get out before last December, at this point, even in the United States, can't get out.
That's correct. I mean, there are a few annual conferences that are allowing churches to kind of negotiate a way out. But the vast majority are being discouraged by their bishops and leaders from any kind of disaffiliation at all.
There are several churches that are waiting to see. I've been to some of these churches. I've talked to them where some of the leaders have said to me, well, if they ever actually change the discipline, then we'll leave. Or if they say, well, we'll just wait to see when these type of things happen in our area. How do you respond to that? Like, what are some of the challenges in that situation? And then, the second part of this question would be, on the other side, will those type of churches that are waiting, maybe in 5 to 10 years, could there be still an avenue for them to leave? Is that what you're working on? Sorry, I asked too many questions there. So, okay, let's just respond to the first one first. Like, what do you say to those folks who are saying, well, I'll just wait for it to be explicit?
Well, it's going to be difficult for them. For example, the Mississippi Conference put in this idea that you don't have to get out now. You can wait till after general conference. And there were, I think, about 100 churches that have waited on their process. And then in January, they decided, oh, no, if you want to disaffiliate, you have to have been in the process by the end of March. Otherwise, and the point of waiting was to wait till after general conference. But now they're insisting that they go before general conference. So they still don't know. And the point of waiting was totally missed. And I think that's probably the case in other places as well, that, you know, we can see the handwriting on the wall. We know what's going to happen. We know that the church is going to change its standards about sexual morality and its definition of marriage. That group within the General Conference has a majority of the votes, especially in the wake of the fact that many delegates who were traditionalists have disaffiliated. So there are far fewer traditional delegates at the General Conference than there were in previous years. So it's pretty certain that those changes are going to happen. And so churches that have waited, they may find themselves in a very difficult position.
So hopefully this General Conference will come up with a mechanism for those churches, once they realize this, to still leave. So there's legislation that's proposed on that side.
There is. Of course, the centrists and progressives in the church are very opposed to that idea. They want to turn the page. They're done with disaffiliation. They're very frustrated and angry about the number of churches that disaffiliated. They never thought that as many as 25% of our churches would disaffiliate. They thought maybe 5%. And so, you know, the fact that 25% have gone, they view that as a tragedy, and they view it as the result of misinformation that Good News and others are spreading, which is, of course, ridiculous. But they believe churches have been deceived, and they believe churches can't make a good decision or have made poor decisions to disaffiliate. They think some churches are more Baptist than Methodist, and they just want to be independent. There are all kinds of excuses that they give for why churches have disaffiliated rather than looking at the reasons why churches do that. But the bottom line is they're very upset, and they're not willing to continue opening that door for continued disaffiliation. And so they're very opposed to the proposals that we put forward.
Is a sense that it is maybe one of their arguments that it was the United Methodist Church that brought this here, kind of like the old idea, like you didn't build this road, you know, this was built by somebody else. You didn't build this church. It was the United Methodist Church that did this all together. And so these are our assets. It seems like that might be the point of power that's being leveraged. It just seemed practical to me to let people leave if they realize that they no longer align with the denomination.
Well, you're right. It is about money and about, you know, having the perception of how many churches we have and that kind of thing. You know, it's totally ridiculous to say, well, this was built by the United Methodist Church. Well, the United Methodist Church has only been around since 1969. So in most cases, the congregation itself has built that church and has built and provided for it and maintained it over the years. The conference, in most cases, has not put a penny into that local church property, and yet they're claiming that it belongs to them. Well, they're saying the money that was given to support that church was given by faithful United Methodists of the past, and they wouldn't want it going to a different denomination, except they don't realize that the people who gave that money 20, 30, 50, 75 years ago would never have encountered or approved of the changes that they're making to the Book of Discipline and the changing in churches' teachings. So they would have been right in the front row of those wanting to disaffiliate. So it's a lot of disingenuous arguments.
Yeah, for sure. Tom, what are some of the things that are happening here? You're at the conference now. It's going on. There's been some questions about what's happening with African delegates and the way that they've been provided for along the way, those who haven't been able to come. Give us an update there.
So in any normal year, probably 30 to 40 delegates are unable to attend because they're unable to get their visa to come to the U.S. And this is a real problem that's been in existence for quite some time. But the problem was made much worse this time around by the fact that the staff of the General Church has failed to send out the appropriate paperwork to delegates far enough in advance for them to be able to go through the process of getting their visas. In some of the countries in Africa, the wait time for an appointment to get a visa is 4 to 6 months. Wow. Well, the delegates did not get their letters of invitation until about 2 to 3 months ago. And so they were like past the window of being able to make an appointment. Some of them had to travel to other countries in order to get a visa appointment. Some were turned down for that very reason. Number of Nigerians had to go to Liberia to get their visa appointment. And the consular office at the embassy said, well, why are you here? Why didn't you get your visa in Nigeria? And refused to give them the visa. So we anticipate that out of the 270 or so African delegates, we're only going to have about 200 of them present, and maybe even less than that, which is like double to triple the number of people that normally are without a visa. And we think that that was partly orchestrated by the powers that be in order to keep down the number of African voters so that they can pass the legislation that they want to pass. This idea of regionalization takes a two-thirds vote of the conference to pass it because it modifies the constitution. And so we believe that they would like to see that number as low as possible on the African side, because they might vote against it and therefore scuttle the whole plan for regionalization.
Is there so with these people who have come and haven't been able to participate, there's no way for them to participate just as you and I are communicating over Zoom or anything like that? They can't participate unless they're physically in the room?
That's correct. And part of that is because of the fact that there's committee meetings and things like that that take place, that people interact that way. And the logistics of setting up the denominational meeting for the remote participation would be very difficult. And it's also true that in Africa, the internet reliability is questionable. Sometimes we have trouble, you know, meeting with people that we are serving together with in various boards and committees that we work on a particular day. Oh, the internet's bad today, I'm not be able to participate, that kind of thing. So it's really difficult to do virtual as well. But we believe that if the leaders had listened to the Africans who were asking for this information way last fall, and if they had responded appropriately, then the visa situation would be a lot better today.
Yes. I participated in a couple of GMC convening conferences, Wesley Biblical Seminary. We've been at as many of them as possible. And as somebody who's new to the GMC, this just seems like a spirit-filled environment, and there's occasionally like a couple of legislative pieces that need to happen, and it's been fairly smooth as we've observed them. But it's just a true kind of like, doesn't, as somebody who's new, just seems like a really strong Christian conference of brothers and sisters in Christ coming together and then making a couple of decisions. So I don't have the context for what annual conferences or general conference has been like. So I'm curious what and some of my audience won't be familiar with even the term conference. They would think, oh, okay, I go to the Catalyst Conference or I go to a youth ministry conference. But this is a legislative body, a general conference that goes to make decisions. But there is a side to this that is like a conference, where there are worship services, there's engagement with speakers, there's motivational type of aspects of what it means to be a part of the denomination. And then there are, of course, more probably the function is a legislative function. So you've been to many of these, Tom. How do you describe what's going on in that room, even spiritually, from this sense of like coming together if with a unified function? Like what's it like, and how's it different from other general conferences?
So you're right. It is a combination of worship event and legislative gathering. The whole idea of conferencing is based on Wesley's idea that one of the means of grace is what he called Christian conferencing. And that is, in his usage, people meeting together in groups to talk about their faith and understanding it in a community rather than as an individual, and that we can learn from one another and that kind of thing. But it's kind of morphed over in the denomination to Christian conferencing is how we solve problems. It's how we make decisions. It's a legislative process that is very much like how Congress operates at times.
Yeah.
And some of the same political dynamics that we find going on in Congress also affect the church's legislative process as well. And that's particularly seen in over the last 25, 30 years, the push to liberalize the church's teachings on marriage and sexuality has created this kind of tension between different groups within the church that manifests itself in the legislative process. Because you have to vote up or down on things, and it becomes a contest and a point of tension. So I would say that the intensity of the conflict reached its high point in 2016 at the general conference there, which then led to the 2019 general conference that reaffirmed traditional teaching. And that was like an explosion in the church of controversy. And certain parts of the church just decided, we don't agree with this decision. We're not going to live with it. We're not going to abide by it. And so that really has led to then the disintegration of the denomination in that sense. And so at this general conference, you have that same kind of tension. There's a lot of anger at those who have disaffiliated. There's anger at those who, like us, who are still around, promoting the opportunity for disaffiliation to continue. We're regarded as those who are trying to destroy the church. And so, you know, there is that hostility and animosity toward us that we feel. And I think it probably will be manifested in some of the debates that come about later in the conference. We'll have to wait and see. It may depend on the vote difference. I mean, in 2019, it was a very close vote for a church meeting. It was 53-47%. And so if it's that close again, then, you know, that's a recipe for the tension to exacerbate. But if the vote is more lopsided in favor of one group or another, then the tension is probably not going to get that high.
What about the worship service? Well, by the way, I just want to stop before I talk about the worship services. Thank you for being there. Thank you for this is one of these prophetic like calls that you and Rob Renfro and others have taken on. Like, not many people are willing to say, you know what, I'm going to go into a place where there's a lot of people who probably don't. Not only do they wish I wasn't here, they probably wish I wasn't even alive. You know, like. So thank you for having the courage to stand in there, and particularly in light of those who are seeking opportunities to leave and to really to serve the church as a whole. So I just want to thank you, Tom, for doing that.
Well, we feel that that's part of our calling, and certainly we're doing it out of appreciation for the African delegates in particular, who year after year after year have come over here, endured much hardship to do so, and have voted to maintain the scriptural position of the church. And if it wasn't for them, we long ago would have capitulated to the culture. Mm-hmm. And so because of their faithful witness over the decades, we feel like we owe it to stick around and help them as much as we can. And so that's what we're doing.
Beautiful. So can you talk to me about the worship context? There was one picture that was going around on various social media pages yesterday that had a yoga page and some ancestral, I don't know, some other things I can't quite explain. I don't quite know what they are. So what's the tenor like, the spirit in the room in a worshiping context? Is it moving in the direction of a liberalization there, or what do you see?
Well, worship has always been on the cutting edge of liberalization in the church, United Methodist Church, at least.
Okay.
The in terms of the music that's picked, in terms of the symbolism and the actions. I mean, for example, we had a Native American person get up at the beginning of the worship service yesterday and go to the different directions of the compass and invite the Spirit's presence and all of this through a Native American kind of ritual. Which that kind of thing happens. That's been happening for probably more than a decade. It's interesting that when people introduce themselves, they are now having to name their race, their gender, their pronouns, things like that. that's just part of the norm now. And so it's strikingly in the direction of a much more progressive denomination.
Hmm. So they even say their race?
I'm a black man from so-and-so country. And yeah.
And my pronouns are black. Okay.
Right. Or I identify as male or female or whatever.
Gotcha. So there are probably some people in the room who would still align with a orthodox position on human sexuality, and the churches that they come from would be very surprised at that. To me, it's like, as you're sitting there seeing these type of things, it's obvious what the trajectory is for the United Methodist Church. It's what do you say to folks who are still just saying, well, you know, we have to stay and fight. We're going to stay down. We're going to go down with this ship. And maybe somebody's called to that, but I'm not trying to just win an argument here. It's more out of like a spiritual concern for folks who are maybe putting themselves in a difficult place. How do you respond to your friends who are saying making those type of arguments?
Well, there's different kinds of traditionalists. I mean, there are some traditionalists who believe that they hold traditional positions on all these issues, but they believe as long as they're able to function freely within the denomination that they can stay. And, you know, one word for people like that is a compatibilist person. They're sure. willing to get along with others, and they don't believe that the church changing its teaching officially impacts their own personal ministry at all, or at least not very much. And so they're willing to stick it out. And that's one kind. There are others who want to stick it out because they do want to be a faithful witness for the scriptural truth. And in the midst of the denomination, there's a new group that's just started of young, mostly men, but young people who really do want to take back the denomination. They feel like they're called for the next 40 years to enter this battle. And what I say is, you know, we've been doing this for 50 years.
Okay.
The renewal groups, I mean, this group has accused us of giving up too soon. But we've been doing this for 50 years. And yes, we've been able to hold off the official changes in the Book of Discipline until now, but we've seen the church culture evolve in a much more liberal direction. And as you point out, the trajectory is definitely in that liberal direction. And so it got to the point where we thought, do we want to invest our life and ministry in trying to salvage a denomination? Or do we want to invest our life and ministry in promoting the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Yeah.
And so we made that decision. And I think that's partly what led to the formation of the Global Methodist Church, was that we felt like it wasn't worth the fight anymore. Trying to hang on to a denomination, especially in light of the vast disobedience that was going on and the lack of accountability, the lack of governing structure in the church. It just didn't make sense to invest ourselves in that effort any longer when we could really be devoting ourselves to building something new that promotes the gospel of Jesus Christ in a way that we can relate to.
Yes, beautiful. I think that's the picture of where we're going. It's not just what we're leaving, but what we're called to become. If the legislative process goes the way that you would prefer and that Good News is promoting, and if you're able to make these shifts in the denomination, what do you see as the future of Good News then? Like, I'm curious, because you all have been working for so long with this. If you're able to get a way out, what would you all continue to serve? I mean, I know you can't speak for the organization as a whole. I know there's like a leadership structure and a board and that kind of thing. I'm just curious. It's been such a benefit. I mean, yeah, I could think of a few things you might be able to do, but I'm curious what you all are seeing as your future as an organization.
Well, the mission of Good News has always been to bring renewal and reform to the United Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. If we are no longer part of the United Methodist Church, that kind of changes things. And I'm at the point of personally retiring from ministry.
Okay.
And so there would need to arise another generation of people with a calling. But if we're not within the United Methodist Church, then where are we? And right, what is right. our mission and purpose? So I think that it would be fair to say that we believe our mission will have been accomplished through the formation of the GMC and the faithfulness to the gospel that we see there. And it might be an opportunity for us to celebrate that and to bring the ministry of good news to a close.
Wow. Interesting. And, you know, there's other some United Methodist churches have landed in other denominations. In our area, the Congregational Methodist Church has grown as in light of disaffiliations, as has the Association of Independent Methodists, the Free Methodist Church, and the like. So there's been many ways, and some, of course, have chosen to remain independent. But yeah, that's helpful to consider that there's this new phase to be able to say we did what we did, and we accomplished the purpose for which God raised us up.
Well, you know, it's interesting that institutions always lend towards self-preservation, preserving the institution, but that's not godly. I mean,
wow.
There comes times when the institution needs to say, okay, this is what God has used us for, and he has accomplished his purpose through us, and our purpose is done. We need to be, even in the local church, we need to be willing to say, this time of this ministry is over. We need to start something new. God's doing a new thing. That doesn't mean we need to hold on to all the old things we've been doing. So I think that's a healthy perspective.
Oh, it's wonderfully healthy. I wish that we could hear that in so many, on many other fronts, as we think about what it means to be an organization, even some churches that have moved to a place where they really are dead if they're not going to make changes. And I had Tom Rainer on my podcast a few months ago as he was encouraging churches to think about what it means to now they have this moment of disaffiliation. Well, what do you do with that? And we discussed his book, The Autopsy of a Dead Church or Deceased Church. And he said, you know, one of the things you can do is you can give your building to another church. You can sell your assets, you know, liquidate your assets, and then use them for kingdom purposes, and just recognize that there's other things to do. I don't know what that would mean for good news, but I'm encouraged to hear the way that you're thinking about it. I know it's not an announcement or anything like that. I'm not taking it that way, but I appreciate the way that you all through the years, through Jim Heidegger, was it Kaiser. Kaiser, who is a founder.
Yes.
It's a wonderful testament to the work that you all have done. And there's other churches, I think other denominations might need similar groups to rise up to help to serve those churches.
Well, you know, the same controversy that has beset United Methodism is coming to the Free Methodist Church, the Wesleyan Church, and other denominations that are a more conservative bent. And so that may indeed be true, but that's not us.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you, Tom, for your service. Thanks for coming on this podcast. I have one last question. This is completely unconnected to General Conference. Or let me just give you, is there anything else you'd like to say about General Conference?
I think we've pretty well covered the waterfront, probably more than people wanted to know.
Okay.
But we do appreciate their prayers. Prayers really sustain us during this effort. It's a 2-week slog through this process, and many late nights, early mornings, and a lot of intense effort. And so we really do appreciate the prayers of people and the ability of them to hold us up before the throne of grace.
Amen. And we need to do that. So more to the story, listeners, let's do that. Make sure you're taking time. Just because you might have disaffiliated, or your denomination or your church isn't experiencing this at this point, there are churches that need to disaffiliate and need the mechanism legislatively, legally, to do that. So pray for Tom. Pray for the delegates who are there, who are supporting these processes that Good News is supporting. So we want to do that, and we will do that. Tom, I always ask the question, is there more to the story of Tom? A lot of people know you through the work that you're doing at Good News, your work in ministry. Is there something that you like to do in your spare time that people might not know about you?
Well, I started out my career life as a music teacher, and I play music, and I've led worship for many years in a local church. And so I really enjoy the musical expression of my faith. And that's a part of me that I really enjoy.
What instrument do you play?
So I in college I played trombone, was my main instrument. But after that, when I began to be a worship leader, I picked up the guitar, and so I've been playing that for many years as well.
Oh, fun. Well, I'm a trumpet player. I get
good
that.
For you.
Yeah. There's not as many avenues to use it in the church, but when you get the chance to play, it's great. Well, Tom, thanks so much for your time and the work that God's called you to do and your obedience to his call in your life. It means a lot to me, and I know many people are blessed because of the work that you've done.
Well, thank you for having me on, Andy. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and appreciate the connection with your people.